The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition. We're having a special edition Q&A today. We're going to do a tax-focused Q&A. We've got kind of a series of tax-related questions. So Jim decided to take the day off for the Q&A show, and I've got Bob on the line. He's remote. He's not in the studio, so he'll sound like he's calling in. So hi, Bob. Are you there?
Hi, Chris. I am here.
Perfect. So we are going to deal with probably, we'll try to get through all five. I think we have five questions that we're going to touch on here. And again, so this is a tax-focused Q&A show. And kind of a mixed bag of stuff here, as normal with tax questions and retirement planning, Roths, Roth conversions, and things related to Roths are top of the list here. But yeah, actually, Bob, before we get started, have you been outside today?
I you know what? I have not even stepped out the front door.
Okay. The reason why I ask is they said that we were going to get close to 100 today, and I haven't been outside to test that. I was just curious if you could confirm or deny such a thing.
You know what? I was like, my AC has been running the whole day, so I'm assuming it's pretty warm.
Okay. Okay, great.
But 100, then I heard it's supposed to be at or near 100, I think, all the way through early next week.
Oh, well, now you're really bumming me out.
So it's we're definitely in a stretch without rain in the forecast, so I think we're going to get pretty dry, too.
Okay. So with that in mind, we're in the coolness here in the studio and at Bob at home. So our first question that comes in, and Bob's got the details on this, but we've got a question first on Roth contribution limits and what kind of goes into, quote, earned income for Roth contribution limit purposes. So you can take it away, Bob, and share with us the email that was sent in.
Okay, so we have a listener from Arizona, and he starts out, and he says, I'm 67 years old and have returned to work on a part-time basis in May of 2020, so May of this year, and so far have gross income of $2,233. From that amount, I have made 401k contributions of $2,047. My employer has withheld sums for taxes. Mm-hmm. And is so what he's what he's done is he's gone back to work part-time, and he's chosen to be in his employer 401k plan, and he's putting in what they would call almost like 100% contribution.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a plan election, although I think most plans now have now allow that. In the old days, it was a 15% limit, but then they changed it. So most plans allow the 100%, but it's not really 100% because you still have to withhold Social Security tax and Medicare tax.
Right.
So in reality, you can put in about 92%.
Got it.
Of your gross pay.
So he's gone back, must not need to take it home, so he's just piling it all up in his 401k.
He's saving some more, yes.
Right. Okay.
And his question is, can I contribute to my Roth IRA in 2020? Does the amount I contribute to my 401k count as quote-unquote earned income for Roth contribution purposes? And then he ends by saying, based on the above, what is the maximum I can contribute, if any, to a Roth IRA in 2020? So just the general IRA, Roth IRA contribution limits is your AGI is below 124 for single. And I think it's modified AGI, but below 124 for single and 196 for married filing separately. So we don't have all that information, but I think we'll make the assumption he's well below those limits. So he would be eligible to do $6,000 this year plus $1,000 catch up because he's 67 years old, assuming he has $7,000 of earned income.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's working, so that sounds like earned income, but and they always just say earned income, but what they really should say is taxable earned income.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is an interesting one because he's has income, but he's deferring it all. So it's not showing up, not going to show up on this year's W-2 for tax purposes, the taxable point, you know, that you made a point of there. So he's kind of wanting to double count it, kind of, you know, use it for both contributing to the 401k. He's deferring, you know, almost 100% of it, but then also use that earned income as allowed to be contributed to the Roth, which of course he can't use the same dollars because he's put the dollars in there, but you're not required to use the same dollars. You can use dollars from anywhere. It's really just, does he meet the qualifications for making the contribution in the first place? And in this case, since he's not recognizing it for tax purposes, he's got a little bit of an issue.
Yes, exactly. And so it's a good question because it sounds like, you know, I'm back working and that's earning money and somebody's paying me. Those are earned wages. But because he is doing the near 100% deferral, when he gets, if he was to stop working right now, his box one, which is going to be the box on the W-2 that's going to show taxable earned wages, would say right now $186. And that's just the difference mm-hmm. between the earlier numbers that he provided, which was just set aside to cover primarily Social Security tax and Medicare tax. So his answer is right now he could do $186 if that was worth it to him.
Yeah.
And if he kept working throughout the year and that number gets larger, then you know that it could increase a little bit the amount that he could contribute to a Roth IRA, but it's not going to be very much based on the numbers he's given us so far.
Yeah. First thing I would probably ask him is if he has the Roth 401k option at his work, that if he's going to defer everything, sounds like he'd like to do both. That's going to be a little rough, but if his overall goal is to get money in the Roth instead, maybe he can do a Roth 401k election instead of the traditional 401k election and at least get money into the Roth that way. It would be a Roth 401k, of course, instead of a Roth IRA, but he could get after-tax money starting to accumulate in there instead of pre-tax money, if that's what his goal is. And I'm kind of deducing that he's got some of that goal because he's wanting to do a Roth IRA. We don't have him on the phone to ask him those questions, but if his employer allows that or not, but that would be the one thing I'd point out that might be an option if he's wanting to start to create more of a Roth balance instead.
No, that's a great point. And without knowing, his other information and his other income and taxable income, if he's in a really low bracket, the tax savings, there may be no tax savings from doing a traditional IRA or 401k deferral. And in that case, if the Roth IRA, excuse me, the Roth 401k option was available, that would be ideal for him.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that was an interesting one. I don't think we've answered or we've tackled a question quite like that before. So excellent.
Oh, great. Yeah.
The next one is Roth related. But here it's for someone who's wanting to do Roth conversions and trying to do Roth conversions up to a certain tax bracket. How do they exactly calculate taxable income if he's wanting to get right up to the next bracket in his Roth conversion strategy? I think that's the summary of it, but you can take it away with the details of this next email.
Yes, that's pretty much it. He's in his case, he's targeting the 24% bracket. He's married. So this listener is trying to figure out how much Roth conversion dollars I can do and how does it kind of work with how it's going to get taxed and how does it work with the computation of the taxable income number so I can do my own estimate and say I'm going to convert X number of dollars this year and hit right close to the top of the 24% bracket. I don't want to go higher. And in his case, since he's married, that 24% bracket's currently at the top of that bracket's currently at $326, $600. So he's trying to get to that number, and he has and he's wondering how the income stacks up. And he has earned income, dividends, capital gains, and then this X number, which is the Roth conversion number. That's the variable because that's the number that you can pick. Mm-hmm. And target where you want to target. It says, to determine the tax implication of doing a Roth conversion, this would be greatly appreciated. I'm trying to figure out how much I can convert from my 401k to a Roth IRA and stay below a certain bracket. In my case, I was looking at 24%. So the income descriptions that he's provided, earned income, dividends, cap gains, and then this Roth conversion amount, they're all going to get added together, and that's going to provide you your adjusted gross income, your AGI. And then from there, we're going to deduct either the standard deduction or your itemized deductions. You're going to pick the higher number, and that's going to come down to your taxable income. And that's the target that you're trying to get, in his case, that $326,000 number. And I think what he's really kind of trying to get at, too, is how are different kinds of income that have different tax rates, how do they factor into this formula, or do they factor in this formula? And is there anything, I can do, or how do capital gains factor into my tax bracket that I'm trying to achieve?
Yeah. So this is where a lot of people do get confused. This is a confusing part because the capital gains, long-term capital gains, for instance, being taxed at a different rate, people are usually assuming that there's kind of two separate taxes at work here, or two separate AGIs almost, that determine the rate that's going to get applied to those conversions. But you mentioned a key word, they're stacked. So there's a stacking element to these that will have an effect on what your true marginal tax rate is on the conversions that he's thinking of piling on top of these other three categories that you mentioned, the earned income, dividends, and capital gains. So this is, if as Bob kind of walked through this, if it was hard to visualize in your brain, you're not alone. This is an area that is pretty confusing for a lot of people, even people in the business. So how would he kind of, how do these interrelate, and how does the capital gains recognition ultimately end up affecting how much he could convert and stay within the bracket he wants to stay in?
So basically they all, various types of income taxed at various type of rates, they all get stacked together, and the next dollar of income, depending on the nature of that income is going to get taxed at your ordinary income tax bracket or the long-term capital gain tax bracket. And so I thought what I would do is just kind of walk through a quick example to help see that.
Okay.
And in this example, I'm going to take a single person making $75,000 a year, claiming a standard deduction. That puts them right in the middle of the 22% bracket. And so their next dollar of income, if it's ordinary income, interest, ordinary dividends, maybe a wages or a bonus, if we add $1,000 to his current income, his tax liability goes up by exactly $220, 22%.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say from that scenario, we add $1,000 of a long-term capital gain. We're adding another layer of income, and now his income is going to $77,000 before deductions. And if we look at what happens to his tax liability from adding that $1,000 of capital gain income, it goes up by $150 even, 15%, the bracket that he's in for long-term capital gains.
Mm-hmm.
And then, to take the example one more step, if we add on top of that a third layer of $1,000 of ordinary income, back to ordinary income, we see his bottom line taxes increase again by $220.
Mm-hmm.
So even though we have layers and stacks of income, the next dollar is going to get taxed at the rate, the tax rate associated with the nature of the income that you're adding on.
Right. So I think what confuses a lot of people is they're trying to do this, get or stay within the 24% in the original emailer's question about the Roth conversions, the effective marginal rate on that, or I guess I shouldn't use the word effective because we're only talking about the income taxes here at the federal level. So that 24% getting applied there, they don't realize that the long-term capital gains that they've got has piled up already and maybe pushed you up to closer to or into that 24 bracket earlier than you think. People in their minds, they stack just it's like they stack only the ordinary income affected income, right? So his earned income, and then Roth conversions are going to show up as earned income as far as tax purposes go. It's like they create a separate stack of those, ignoring any possible long-term capital gains that might be over there because they're thinking, oh, that's separate. That's off only at 15% or something. When in fact, it's all in one pile. The net effect is the Roth conversion, more of it might be exposed to the 24 bracket in our original emailer's question than they thought because they were leaving off out of the pile that long-term capital gain piece. So just remember the stacking, I guess, is the main recommendation here.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's a great way to put it. And it's not a parallel, I guess, tax system. It's vertical.
Right.
So just be careful that if you're planning for Roth conversions and you have a bunch of capital gains, and they're tricky, right? Because sometimes you don't know your capital gain distributions until after year end. When you receive your nice consolidated 1099, you say, wait a minute, there's $28,000 of capital gain distributions I wasn't planning on. And now you just push $28,000 of Roth conversion money into that next bracket that you didn't want to do.
That's an excellent point. And also, this kind of supports the thing that Jim and I propose a lot on the show here, which is to wait to determine your Roth conversion amounts to stay within certain limits. Wait until late in the year. And even then, you're not going to quite know because you're going to have maybe these late capital gains that get recognized in certain types of investment holdings that you have. You'll get a notification after the year is over when it's too late to do the conversion, right? Or to fix the conversion. Now, Jim and I have talked about kind of a workaround maybe to buy yourself a little bit of time here via a 60-day rollover. I'm not going to go off on that tangent. We should maybe, we haven't talked about it in a while. That's usually a topic that we talk about in the fall as people are thinking of doing Roth conversions. But since recharacterizations are gone, this used to be an easy issue. We didn't worry about the timing of these so much because we could undo or recharacterize and if we too much of a Roth conversion, if we had one of these, you know, capital gains come in and then we realize, oh my gosh, we didn't realize this. We didn't realize it was going to be so big or we forgot about it. It was no big deal. We could undo it. Now that you can't, you've got to try to anticipate as much of that as possible and get it stacked up properly in order to make that optimal Roth conversion up to a certain limit, or you might find yourself pushed into the next tax bracket unintentionally. That's really the essence of what this person's trying to get at, is how can I get to the limit and how does it stack? The trouble is what Bob just mentioned. Sometimes you get a report of capital gains recognized in one of the investment vehicles that you hold after the year's over. So makes it a bit tough. You can do some estimates on that, or you can choose to hold investments that don't create these issues, which is, you know, easier said than done for some people. But it is something to be aware of or worry about when you're trying to do the optimal, and I'm doing air quotes, Roth conversion in a particular year.
Yeah, it certainly lends itself to maybe even building in just a little buffer if you're just not quite sure.
Well, the nice thing is if you just go a little bit too extra, the harm is that you've exposed a little bit of the Roth conversion to a little higher marginal rate than you wanted to do. So it's usually not going to wreck the whole thing, but it's one of those things where you're going to regret having done it. So having a little cushion might be a good idea if you're really paranoid about staying in the current bracket. Okay, on to the next question here. We've got, this one's going to be Roth conversion related as well, but some questions on maybe doing them later in life than we normally talk about. We talk about Roth conversions often for people still working or in their tax planning window that opens up between retirement and RMD age. So we talk about it a lot in those areas, but what if they're in their mid-70s or so? So that's the next topic. So go ahead and take on that email, Bob.
Okay. Yeah, we're staying with the Roth conversion theme so far today.
Right.
And these listeners are coming in from Jim's home state, Massachusetts.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
We don't get a whole lot of them. It's too bad Jim wasn't on here. We could ask him if he knows him. It's a small state there, right? Not many people there. He might know him.
Not Hurley at all. He probably has run into him before. But they're from the South Shore in the heart of Patriot Nation, so they got that with Jim.
Yeah.
And their question is about the wisdom of doing Roth conversions at this somewhat late stage of our lives, mid-70s.
Mm-hmm.
So we passed on the opportunity to do them an earlier stage of our retirement. That was probably a mistake, but that is water under the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, does it make sense to do them now? And he goes on, he says, his taxable IRAs represent about 25% of our portfolio. Our expenses, he's talking about our living expenses, are currently more than well covered by my pension and two Social Security checks. He is retired Navy, so he has a nice inflation-adjusted pension, and they both have Social Security. His pension is $83,000 a year, and their combined Social Security is another $33,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
We live pretty well on the pension and occasionally dip into Social Security when we need it. We live, they're enjoying their retirement and doing what they want to do, but they're not overly extravagant either. Since they're in their mid-70s, so and he provides a lot of details and everything, but essentially, you know, his question is, you know, should we still consider doing these Roth conversions, even though he's kind of deduced that they're sort of a wash right now,
mm-hmm.
And so where he kind of you know, what he's kind of thinking is we have kind of a known income that's really not going to change a lot going forward. We have pension that's going to go up a little bit. We have Social Security that's going to go up a little bit. And our RMDs are going to keep increasing a little bit every year. But we know what bracket we're in now. And in 10 years from now, we may be in the same, likely to be in the same bracket as brackets go up with inflation, income kind of follows. So the whole, are we going to be in a better tax bracket now or later? Or is it going to go lower or higher? He kind of knows that's all going to be about the same for the time that both of them are alive. And so the traditional window has kind of come and gone, you know, and where you might have a lower income, and it really makes sense to do those conversions. Right now, that window's kind of passed. So, you know, what should we think about? Mm-hmm. And really it comes down to, and we've talked about some of these items before, and I know you guys have as well, but a couple things to start to consider is, one, what's going to happen with tax rates? They're likely to go up in 2026. At least that's when the current rate reductions expire. Mm-hmm. And they go back. So that could add a couple percent to the brackets. And what if we have a change in policy or administrations in 4 years or next year, or and do they increase rates beyond even what's expected? Mm-hmm. So you have an unknown there.
Yeah, so you have right now you know what the rates are. If you would like to lock those in, Jim always talks about prepaying the taxes. So you've got this embedded tax obligation in these tax deferred accounts. And strangely, unlike a lot of other income that comes in out of your control as far as timing goes, like the pension, you can't prepay the taxes on your pension that will be paid to you in 5 years. But you can prepay today the taxes on a distribution from your tax deferred accounts that you might not be intending to take for 5 years. So you do have more control in recognition of income for tax purposes when you're dealing with these tax deferred accounts that he's thinking of doing conversions out of. So I agree that right now we're probably at a bit of a low spot, if you will, in tax rates, although I don't know what bracket he's in. He might, well, he with the income that he listed, he's not in the, one of the really low brackets that could go down, right? There depending on how politics go over the coming 5 to 10 years, I could see tax relief for lower income folks and a ratcheting up of tax rates with higher. And I said could see. I don't see it for sure, right? Don't have a crystal ball. But in the brackets that he's talking about being in with the income he has with the pension and the Social Security, he could lock in today's rates effectively by doing conversions now and protect himself from future tax increases if he instead delayed taking them out either on the RMD schedule or you know, voluntary distributions or conversions later on. So I agree with Bob that there's a, you know, tax uncertainty that you could turn into a certainty by doing conversions, and that might be attractive.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And he just to point out, he did mention that he's currently in the 22% bracket, and he's kind of identified another second reason to maybe consider Roth conversions, even though it looks on the surface as a wash.
Right. I have two other, we'll see what he says. I have two other recommendations too, but what has he come up with?
So he's already done the analysis of what happens if his wife predeceases him or he predeceases her. And this is the widow-widower situation. And he says, if my wife predeceases me, I will definitely be in the 24% bracket and may edge into the 32% bracket. And then it's a somewhat similar scenario if he predeceases her. Mm-hmm. So he's identified a second reason to look at Roth conversions is let's keep, you know, having our income jump when one of us dies first. Mm-hmm. And that's just a factor of the brackets, you know, single versus married and and the standard deduction and things all change. And he's already figured out, he knows they're going to go up.
Right. And that's effectively what he's describing as a built-in under current tax law. And unless the tax rules are completely redone, the single brackets will be smaller than the married filing joint brackets. And you can see not just not a political change, but just the loss of one of the two spouses creates what Jim and I always refer to as the widow-widower tax penalty. And by converting now, while both are alive, they take advantage of the married filing joint brackets and prevent maybe a spike in the marginal tax rates applied to future distributions, required or not, when the single is left. That there's generally a time period where one of the two of them will be alone and filing single. So that was one of the two I wanted to point out. So I'm glad that he's already thinking along those lines, because that would add even more support for doing conversions while the two of them are still alive. Does he
exactly.
have a, does he have another reason?
He doesn't mention he does. He mentions they have two adult daughters.
So he does have kids.
So he has kids. He has two adult daughters. And so that takes us to, a third reason.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, do you want to make your beneficiaries have a more tax-friendly estate left to them?
Yep. That was the third one I would definitely mention as well.
And so that's a big third consideration is, are they working? If they're married, are their spouses working? What bracket are they in? What if they were in the 35% bracket?
Mm-hmm.
And then we don't have a stretch IRA anymore. So these IRAs get left to them. They inherit them, and they have a 10-year period to withdraw those assets, either all at once, at the end, along the way. But either way, as a family unit, it could create more taxes as a family. So does it make sense to prepay some taxes for your children so that their taxes are lower than by what you just prepaid by?
Yep, absolutely. More? And it's one of those things where two factors, I'd say, for the kids. If the kids are going to be in high brackets themselves, particularly when they're forced to take this money out within a 10-year period, so you have to worry about that piece as well. The second issue is, so even if you can't predict what kind of career they're going to be in, they say adult daughters, we don't know how old they are, if they've got established careers, it's going to be very different if they're a high-earning a plastic surgeon versus a school teacher, or those types of things are going to factor into anticipated tax rates for them, always keeping in mind that they'll have to take it out within that 10-year period. But also a control issue, if you're worried about these assets flowing out and you want to retain some control for them, protection against maybe a divorce or creditors or other predators that might come along, traditional tax-deferred assets are terrible to leave to a trust, whereas Roth assets wouldn't have to be. They could pass if you're not worried about these issues, but could in a much more friendly manner for tax purposes flow to a trust for control for the daughters, to protect the inheritance for the daughters. Whereas if they have to head towards the trust but still in tax deferred status, now you're setting up a tax time bomb that could go off inside that trust. We've talked about it ad nauseum on previous shows, Jim and I. I'm sure you've been on a few of the shows too, Bob, but it's, here's another factor. They don't need it, so it's really should I just leave it in there and only take out the RMDs, or should I do something a little more proactive? And with kids involved in an inheritance, here's another reason why you might want to seriously consider doing Roth conversions now.
Yeah, so there's quite a bit to consider, and it's sort of a number. You're still looking at the numbers, but it becomes a little bit less of a numbers game because you're not exactly measuring tax savings with known information, known facts, but you're making assumptions, and there's going to be some trends, and depending on some of that information that, you know, that we don't know, we would ask more questions if we were looking at this, mm-hmm. and try to understand. We might not be able to say exactly how many dollars you can save, but we can tell you that based on these other things happening or these other scenarios, it would be a tax savings to do some Roth conversions earlier.
Yep. Yep. So, yeah. So I guess the simple answer is, I think they asked, should we consider it? And yeah, you should consider it. Not guaranteed you should do it, but you absolutely should be considering it for the various reasons that we've mentioned here. Some you've already picked up on, but I think the inheritance issue is also one to seriously consider as a justification for doing conversions now.
Exactly.
Okay.
Very good.
So next email is, we're going to get off of Roth conversions and go to still tax related, but someone wrote in about getting ACA premium tax credits and kind of maybe trying to manipulate recognized income or AGI, specifically modified AGI for ACA premium tax credit purposes. So it's ACA related now instead of Roth conversion. So what did they say, what state they're on in this one?
They are in California.
Perfect.
They're in California and they're a Rams fan. It's funny how everybody writes in about football.
Well, it's because not so much anymore. I think Jim had a real, his real attraction was to Tom Brady. And now that Tom Brady has moved from his home team, he doesn't talk about football nearly as much. And plus we're not in football season. I guess it'll probably, it'll
bit,
ratchet
yeah.
up a
I
little
figured.
Bit more in the fall, assuming we have a football season. But we spent probably way too much time in the past talking about football. But anyway.
That's what I was gathering. I was like, you know, it's kind of a little trend here. So that's right. Great. I'm a big football fan, so that's great. He's 31 years old, and he's been helping out his parents with their retirement and their planning for and during retirement. And he's a dutiful listener to the podcast. And so his situation is this. His father is 68 years old and his mother is 63. My parents both get insurance coverage through my dad's current employer of over 35 years. Mm-hmm. And it's he does say his father's employer. I won't mention it, but it's a very large retailer. It starts with W. So.
Okay.
You know, his original plan was to work till 70 and then retire, at which point my mom would be over 65 and they both have Medicare. Unfortunately, my father's company has decided to eliminate his position. And as a result, he stopped working in May of this year. Here is the conundrum. I find themselves in for getting health insurance coverage for my mother for the rest of this year. They are currently in the 12% bracket, but will be in the 22% bracket in 2 years due to Social Security, pensions, and other income.
Mm-hmm.
Because of this, in January of this year, so before they found out his father was going to be out of work, they decided to sell $20,000 of equities with a $10,000 basis. So that generated $10,000 of capital gain to take advantage of the 0% capital gains rates. So all the planning in the world sometimes can fall apart when something that you're not expecting happens. So unexpected layoff. But he did have a decent severance package. So now all of a sudden, even though his father's not working the rest of the year, he's got a severance package, which unexpectedly increased their income.
Okay.
And at this point, their income for the ACA ends up being approximately $69,000, which is $1,500 above the cliff to be eligible for ACA subsidies, which is the credit available through the health insurance marketplace. This is after I factor in a $14,000 traditional IRA contribution for 2020, normally would be Roth. Okay, so now he's suggesting he do traditional IRA contributions to try to bring this. The goal here is to try to bring the AGI down or the modified AGI down. So there's some benefit through the ACA subsidy that would be available to them.
Mm-hmm.
And now if his father was the only one working, which he states, the spousal rule allows the $7,000 for both,
right,
if
for
they
each
file
one.
A mm-hmm. married filing joint return. Yes. So that's how they're able to do the $14,000.
So the 69 AGI you said is after he's already taken that off, trying to shave that down?
Yeah.
Okay, so he's already shaved it down to 69 down by having them do traditional deductible contributions to the IRA.
Mm-hmm.
Or IRAs,
so,
two of them.
IRAs, yeah, we had two traditional IRAs. And so at this point, before I even gotten this far, I was thinking of things to myself, and I thought, well, an HSA is another way to getting a little over $7,000 now down as a deduction from AGI. But he already considered that, because he goes on to say their health insurance plan does not qualify for HSA to possibly reduce their MAGI for 2020.
So is he... Doesn't she need coverage this year?
She does. So they're they have coverage, and it's not a high deductible plan.
Not the one they're currently on, but when they go out to shop in the marketplace, they do have high deductible plan choices.
So no, that's a good point.
So he might be able to still open the door for the HSA contributions this year for them. By making this, I mean, this might be the golden key for them, but they would have to choose a high deductible plan, which, again, they may not be able to necessarily afford the out-of-pocket if there's a lot of health problems, but sounds like they have some assets, and they're really trying to do tax planning and try to get those ACA tax credits. But my first reaction is, don't give up on the HSA technique.
Yeah, I like that. And you're right. Because of his employment ending, you're allowed to, right, a life-changing event allows you to,
yep,
shop in the marketplace and obtain health insurance during the middle of the year,
right,
rather than at the end of the year when the typical open enrollment occurs. So that is a good consideration. If they were candidates for a high deductible plan, depending on, you know, their current medical situation and bills, that might be a great way to do it, because that would be a very easy way to reduce your AGI by up to $7,000 or $7,200. And actually, I think with catch-up, it'd be even more than that. So that would clearly get them below their level that they're trying to target.
Right. And you wouldn't have to permanently choose the high deductible plan. If they wanted to switch to a different plan next year, they could. They just wouldn't be able to make the contributions anymore, but he's going to transition onto Medicare since he's 68. So it's really just coverage for the mom. He cannot make a contribution into a high deduct or into an HSA because he'll be on Medicare. So he's got to be careful with that, but she still will be able to make contribution to an HSA, and you wouldn't have to do the full maximum. If the key is they're trying to find a way to get $1,500 out of their AGI, she could put $1,500 or a couple thousand, if he's done his math correct and he's comfortable with the numbers, into the HSA, and maybe solve the problem for this year, and then start next year fresh anew without this severance payout that is really kind of undermining their overall tax planning.
Yeah, it sounds like, and that was a good point. Thank you, Chris. I forgot he is 68, so he would not be eligible for an HSA, but she would be.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. It sounds like they're just trying to like bridge a one year fix.
Mm-hmm.
So the high deductible plan, it's not something you'd have to live with really beyond the rest of this year.
Right. Yep. Are there other,
so
I think
trying,
he was trying some other techniques though, because he gave up on the HSA, but I don't, again, because she gets kind of a fresh swing at the ball, right? Or another bite at the apple, or however you want to describe it. She's got a fresh opportunity to choose a plan that could qualify possibly for the HSA.
But I think that's a great consideration. And they would probably have to do it sooner than later, because I think there is a time frame from the life-changing event. But
right.
That would certainly be something to consider. And he goes on to, well, you know, he's looking for a, you know, another way is a $1,500 capital loss, a secure way of obtaining a $1,500 capital loss. I could give you some stock picks, and that probably would help you out. But just in case I got lucky, I wouldn't want to do that.
Right.
He seems pretty knowledgeable, and he's pretty in tune with this. So I'm assuming he's looked through their investment account for unrealized losses that he could sell and trigger a $1,500 loss. Unrealized loss meaning something in their account that's worth $1,500 or more, less than what they purchased it for, their cost basis.
Right.
And I would sell that. I would trigger that loss, and just be careful of the wash loss rules,
mm-hmm.
So that you don't repurchase that asset or a similar asset within 31 days, or that loss that you triggered would then be disallowed.
Right.
And
right.
You wouldn't get anywhere with that.
In this case, you want to definitely hold on to the loss to accomplish his goal. So there's a possibility, without having to go down this HSA path, if they're not interested in that, if he could identify such a thing, does he say, did he mention that as a possibility, or was he just asking if it was worth going to look for such a thing, or did he say he couldn't find a loss in their portfolio?
He did not address whether there was existing losses or not in okay. their portfolio. So he was just looking for something that would trigger that kind of loss,
mm-hmm.
to make that reduction in the AGI. And again, you know, I would carefully look item line by line through my broker statement and see, and with, you know, and this is going to vary from now to the end of the year. You could have a loss show up, and as soon as it shows up, if something goes down with market volatility, sell it, you know, trigger it, mm-hmm. lock it in. The realization of the sale is what's going to create that loss and, mm-hmm. and have it stick with you, and then talk to your broker, or if you're doing it yourself, just make sure you don't run afoul of the wash sale loss rules,
mm-hmm.
So that the effort that you obtained isn't lost.
Yeah. Okay. Any other ways he could magically reduce his AGI?
You know, nothing that I could really think of. You know, I mean, a business loss or rental loss. You know, I don't know that I'd go to the trouble of, I mean, you know, starting a business, it has to be legitimate, and it can't be a hobby. And,
yeah.
You know, and to lose money now and without a bona fide purpose, you know, I wouldn't suggest that, I guess, unless there was something on somebody's mind already. And certainly in the beginning of something, you know, in retirement, if you're starting a new business in the beginning, there quite often are some small losses, and those would be available to you, and they would offset your AGI.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd have to have a bona fide purpose and reason other than just tax avoidance, because that will always come back to get you.
Yeah, the other thing I was going to point out, too, that you mentioned before, it's, I think, I don't know if it was in his email or if you mentioned it, and it was called a cliff for the ACA. It's not actually quite a cliff. It's a very, I would say, if everyone holds their arm up like an elbow, put your hand straight up in the air, your arm from the shoulder to the elbow out perpendicular, sounded like Jim there, to your body, and kind of trace your elbow there. See how it's kind of rounded? You don't have it's not like you have a perfect 90-degree angle there at your elbow. It's a little, some more rounded than others, I'm sure, depending on the size of your arm, but you get the idea. It's pretty aggressive, but it's not quite a cliff. So he might be fixated on this $1,500 number, and maybe it's $1,500 to get the maximum credit, but he is going to be close enough for them to maybe get most of the credit, depending on exactly where it falls in, you know, the premiums for their state and that sort of thing. But it isn't actually a true cliff. Cliff meaning you go $1 past a certain limit and you give up all the benefits. It's kind of an elbow, I call it. human elbow in particular.
There's a little bit of easing in and out of that.
Yeah, but it's pretty aggressive. Situation. So it's a lot of people kind of consider it a cliff, but it's not technically a cliff. So he should make sure that as he's throwing all these numbers in, he can put in when he goes to shop, when he goes to help them shop, he can put in the anticipated AGI and play with the numbers and kind of deduce how the elbow looks for those plans and the credit that they get. And maybe my point is maybe he's over fascinated with this magical $1,500 number and it, you know, the difference may not be as great as he thinks it is between those two, because I was under the impression you didn't give up all of the credits until you were in the mid-70s, 70,000, because it's four times the poverty level, but it's not adjusted, believe it or not, it's not by state. It's actually the federal poverty level. So that part is consistent. The plans are different from state to state, but the cutoff for the credits is based on this four times poverty level measurement. And the formula that creates the elbow exists. I haven't seen it, but I don't think he's given up all the credits. I don't think she gives up all the credits at 69. But I haven't looked at it for a couple of months in that level of detail. So I'm not going to swear to it until I look at it again, but just wanted to clarify that it wasn't a true cliff.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. It may be, it could be just a, you know, kind of a smaller haircut than I think he was estimating that if he was to achieve this $1,500 reduction, you know, she would save somewhere around $4,000 to $5,000, but maybe it's not that, like you said, Chris, maybe it's not that exact. Maybe it's a little softer and maybe it's somewhere in between.
Yeah,
and it's not as bad as it could be.
Yeah, what is a cliff is IRMA, and some people kind of conflate those two. ACA and IRMA are two separate things. IRMA for Medicare premiums is a cliff. You go $1 past the limit and you're in the next tier. That's a true cliff. But ACA premium tax credits are a little more of an elbow, a human elbow. So, okay. Well, anything else you need on before we go to the last question?
No, I think that was kind of it. I mean, I guess my only last thought was, you know, I guess you could, I don't know, you tell me your thoughts, but you could make an investment and, you know, they obviously have a broker account. They've already sold something this year. Is you kind of have, if you were to make a new investment, you kind of have a potential to win both sides, both ways. You know, if it goes up, great. Now you have some extra funds for the health insurance. If it goes down, you have your capital loss before the end of the year.
That's an interesting way. Yeah, that's an interesting way of kind of describing a bit of a hedge, if you will. Benefits on both sides. If they have only, maybe they've got most of their holdings are long term, and they all have really big gains. So there's no chance any one of them are going to dip low enough to create this unrealized loss that they could turn into an actual realized loss for purposes of their AGI reduction technique here. So what Bob is saying, a new investment would start at least neutral. It would start with a cost basis equal to the investment amount. And then depending on if it goes up or down, right, you get a form of a, quote, win either way. If it goes down, that helps you reduce your AGI for the year for ACA premium tax credits. If it goes up, give up on that. You've just potentially increased your AGI, although you wouldn't have to sell it if it went up. But if you needed to, in order to afford to pay some of the premiums, it's helped you do a little bit of that. So that's an interesting thing. There's no way we can tell you what to invest in. That's not something we would do even if we were allowed to do it, but that certainly would not be something or any responsible retirement planning podcaster would try to tell you to do, but worth considering out there. I probably like that one the least. I think the pursuit of the HSA technique is the best one to investigate first, but... Yeah, and then look and make sure that you're not chasing the tail on this, that you're not creating a bigger problem than it actually is. Make sure you truly understand the impacts on the premium tax credit from this little bit of AGI you're trying to reduce, and see if it's even worth going through, you know, jumping through the hoops trying to make it happen.
Right. So. Exactly. Yeah. That's, okay. That's very good. It's kind of interesting. I haven't seen, well, I guess, you know, from time to time, but you haven't seen where very often where somebody's, you know, trying to lose a little bit of money and actually save more money by losing a little bit of money. You just sort of goes kind of contrary to everything you think about, but that's their case.
Yep. Okay. Well, do you think we can do the last question in about 5 minutes? That's about how long we have left.
I think we can. Yeah, I think we can kind of cover this quickly. We're actually, it's kind of back to a Roth topic. So we're 4 out of 5 on the Roth conversions. And this writer just writes in, and you know, he has done some Roth conversions already this year, and he knows he has to pay some tax on it. He says, I realize it's best to pay the taxes with money outside the IRA. What he's right about that. That makes your effective Roth conversion even better if you don't have to use some of those same dollars for the taxes. If you're able to pay for those taxes with outside money, it makes it even better. And but I still don't know the best way to actually get the additional tax money to the IRS. Have I said go Pats yet? Another football comment. So. And he's currently working, so he's doing he's probably what we put into the more traditional time period of Roth conversions, working near the end of working or early retirement. And the way to look at this, and he even asked about increasing his withholdings through his W-2. And so you just want to protect yourself if you want to avoid an underpayment penalty. Is you want to pay in 100% this year of what you owed last year. Mm-hmm. So if you look at last year's 1040 and you look at your tax liability line and say, is my withholdings this year going to be a dollar more than that number? At 100% or more, mm-hmm. You are protected for any increase, and just pay your taxes when you file your return.
Right.
And no penalties or interest.
Right. So even if you owe a whole bunch more because of this Roth conversion, as long as you withheld 100% of what you owed in taxes last year, you get one of these get out of jail free cards for under withholding. And if this is kind of a one-time thing and not an ongoing year after year thing, that would be probably the simplest way. You don't have to worry about trying to send in extra money or quarterly estimated payments or anything. Just make sure your W-2 withholding amounts are enough where you're protected with this get out of jail free card. So that's a good point. I think that sounds the simplest to me in this case, but what other ways could he do this?
Well, he could make a quarterly estimated payment, and you can do that online at the irs.gov website. You can set up an account, and you're not trying to necessarily figure out what you might owe overall, although you could do it that way if you just want to get it done with, or you could just pay in enough again to get you above the magic number of the prior year. But withholdings, either looking at your pay stub and making sure it's going to come out to be higher, or talking to your HR folks, or going to the online HR portal and just making an increase yourself just to cover that. And this year, some years, you know, we see the tax withholding tables get reduced. They like to come up with a way of increasing people's paychecks sort of artificially because it costs you at the end of the year. They have not done that this year. And so I've seen years where everybody's tax withholdings drop, you know, a few $100, $500, $1,000 for the year. And then that makes them short. They're unprotected. You always have the ability to pay in 90% of your current year tax too. That's the other safe harbor. But generally with Roth conversions, you're not going to get to that 90% number. So you have to focus on the 100% of the prior year. And the only other one thing I wanted to add is if your AGI in the prior year is over 150,000, that number needs to be 110%. So you have to be a little careful.
Yeah. Good point for a few people. AGI, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. Okay.
And that would be a case maybe that, you know, you'd have to actually increase your holdings if you were trying to cover 110% of the prior year. Your normal withholdings, even though they may increase with the pay increase, that still may not be enough to get you to 110%.
Okay. Perfect. Well, sounds good. Thanks for being on here with me doing a tax-focused Q&A show. So if you've got your own tax questions, you can send them in. I'll turn you loose, Bob, and I'll call you back for our next activity here. But there's no reason for you to hang on the phone for me to play the ending of the show. So I'll turn you loose. Have a good day.
Okay, you too, Chris. Okay. Talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks, Bob.
Okay.
And we want to thank all of our listeners for sticking with us for another Q&A show. This was, again, tax-focused, obviously. If you've listened to it, you know that now. And if you have your own tax questions or broader retirement planning questions, you can send them to us by going to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. I'll make sure to let Jim know that he missed out on several Pats fans, or at least claiming to be Pats fans today. He'll be sad that he didn't get a commiserate with them, I guess, at the loss of Tom Brady heading to Tampa Bay. But on that same website, getting back on track here, you can learn a little bit more about us, what we do. And if you want to send in a question for the show or have a topic suggestion for the EDU show that we do, we're always happy to hear those. But thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
Investors should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of investment company products carefully before investing. The prospectus contains this and other information about the investment company. Prospectuses may be obtained from your advisor and should be read in full. All guarantees are backed by the claims-paying ability of the issuing insurer. Withdrawals and death benefits are subject to income tax. If withdrawals and other distributions are received prior to age 59 and a half, a 10% penalty may apply. Shares, when redeemed, may be worth more or less than the original cost.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.